It wasn't that long ago, just a few decades, when owning a newspaper or a broadcast TV station was looked upon as a license to print money. Old media made piles of money from advertising, and that paid for programs and staff and special projects. Then along came the internet. People get their information and their entertainment in very different ways today, which means the eyes and ears that once landed upon advertisements in old media land upon them less often. Revenue for old media has plummeted, while places like Google and Facebook seem to vacuum up ad dollars now. We get a much fuller version of the story from Ken Auletta in his book Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. Ken Auletta started writing the Annals of Communication Profiles in The New Yorker back in 1992, but that was far from his first gig. Ken is the author of 11 books, including Hard Feelings, Media Man about Ted Turner, Highwaymen, and Googled among them. Ken Auletta, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure.
So your first book was about New York's decline in the late 70s. It talked about the city being hit by a Category 5 economic and social storm. How would you rank the storm that hit the media business?
Same. It's a Category 5 storm. If you think about what's happened to newspapers, as you said in your intro, or magazines, where's Newsweek? Where's U.S. News and World Report? Look at Time Magazine, how thin it is. And look at how advertising... Google, Facebook and Google have much more ad dollars than newspapers, all the newspapers combined in the U.S. do. When they started by losing classified ads, which represented roughly 25% of their advertising revenue, that's all gone. And ads for stores, et cetera, have largely disappeared. So newspapers are in trouble. Music before that in trouble. Magazines in trouble. And many TV networks and stations in trouble. So the traditional, or what's called legacy media, has been upended by the digital revolution.
You say, though, that we're not going to see advertising itself disappear, a long shot from it. Capitalism, you say, could not exist without marketing, really?
Well, think about it. I mean, what the purpose of marketing or advertising is to put a buyer and a seller together. You didn't have advertising in the former Soviet Union. You didn't in much of China for a very long period of time, and therefore private enterprise didn't exist. So it is essential for private enterprise, and that's not an endorsement of advertising in the sense that so much of advertising is manipulative, emotionally manipulative, and tricks you and treats you as if you're a five-year-old. On the other hand, it doesn't deny the fact that advertising is essential as a funding mechanism, certainly for media, and not just media, for apps, for the internet. It's absolutely vital. And if that's in trouble, then everything else is in trouble.
Well, and this helps explain the title of the book, Frenemies. Who are the frenemies here?
Well, if you're an ad agency, the frenemies are people who used to be your partners. Publishing companies are now, like the New York Times or Vice Media or BuzzFeed, are advertising agencies. So they're your platform for your ads, but they're also your competition. PR agencies increasingly are becoming ad agencies. Consulting companies like Deloitte or IBM are increasingly buying up agencies. And if you think about clients are increasingly saying, let's do stuff in-house and go to and bypass the agency themselves. And then, of course, you got Facebook and Google, who have all this data, and they're going directly to clients. They're frenemies. But the existential frenemy, the real threat to all of advertising, not just the agencies, is the public. The public doesn't like ads, particularly on their cell phones, which feel like an interruption. And if you look at the numbers, 20% of Americans have an ad blocker on their phone, blocking ads. One-third of Western Europeans have ad blockers on their phones. And you look at people who record programs on their PBRs, 55% of them, when they record a program and they play it back, they skip the ads. And then you got Netflix and HBO without ads. So people increasingly are saying, I view ads as an interruption, and therefore I want an ad-free environment. Well, that's a real menace, an existential threat to advertising itself.
Which is interesting in itself because of the fact that the ad blocker probably came to those people for free because it was subsidized by advertisements.
Yeah, and what the ad blockers do is they basically try and extract from companies saying, we won't block your ads if you pay us a fee. Which is really kind of unbelievable.
You know, the part I'm always struck with in this is that it seems like the ad business got struck unaware. And this is a business that is supposed to know what tastes are and what trends are. And it still seems to have been caught somewhat flat-footed by the wrenching change to its own business.
But this is very common. You know, Clayton Christensen, a professor at Harvard, wrote a book some years ago called The Innovator's Dilemma. And in it, he posited the following thesis, that companies that are very successful in their traditional business have a very hard time basically shedding that traditional business that's generating their profits and investing, taking money and investing it in something new that might compete against the new threat, in this case, the digital threat. And so they tend to hang on to the old business too long. And also, you know, people who, if you're in your 60s and you're CEO and you're a manager of that company, you're not an owner, you didn't start the company, you say, I've got five more years, my stock is doing reasonably well, I'm generating profits, I'm not going to worry about this business 10 years from now. I'm going to worry about this year and this quarter and next year. And that's it. And inevitably, you often get disrupted. This is not peculiar to the ad business. I mean, I saw it when I was writing about Google and how they were disrupting traditional media, be it newspapers or magazines. I saw it with the television networks as they were being disrupted in the late 80s by cable. It's a very commonplace thing. And people tend to lean back and say, oh, woe is me, this is a real problem, instead of saying, looking at the digital revolution and saying, this is an opportunity, and I have to lean forward and try new things.
All right, we'll figure out what some of the new things are and talk about what's been going wrong with the old things as we further explore the advertising business and what has happened to it. Ken Auletta is the author of Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Ken Auletta, well known to longtime readers of The New Yorker, but he's also written 11 books. His latest is called Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. What has happened to American advertising is what happened to a lot of media organizations once the Internet came along and began scrambling the eggs that everybody had come to know so well for so many decades. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Ken, the first vignette in the book is John Mandel speaking to the Association of National Advertisers in 2015. Why is this such a critical moment?
Well, because what he was saying is that the holding companies, and there are about five giant holding companies that own an array of ad agencies, they're claiming that under pressure, financial pressure, what these agencies do is hide income that they generate at the expense of their clients. And he made that accusation, and that accusation triggered a tremendous amount of distrust and triggered clients, meaning the advertisers, saying, we're going to review not only our contracts with our agencies, but we're going to review whether we want to continue to do business with those agencies. And that created this level of mistrust helped undermine the advertising business, because suddenly the partners, meaning the client and the agency, didn't feel like partners. They felt like adversaries or frenemies. And that became a real problem. And that allowed me to introduce one of the main characters in my book, this fellow Michael Kasson, who runs a company called MediaLink, and he's basically a connector between the advertiser and the clients and the agencies and the different publishing platforms. And so if you're in an insecure industry full of anxiety about the future, what I report on in the book is how many of them turn to this guy, Michael Kasson, and his company for a sense of security and a sense of this is what we should be doing.
So the part of this, though, where people were shocked to find out that they weren't perhaps getting all their money spent wisely as they as they dealt with advertising agencies. Having worked in the creative side briefly in a television station, I was aware of the fact that it was kind of like the airlines. Everybody on the plane paid a different price to go the same leg of the trip. So there's a lot of voodoo in advertising anyway, it seems like. So, I mean, was this sort of like being shocked that there's gambling going on in the casino?
Yeah, partly that was true. And partly it was just the level of anxiety on everyone in this ecosystem, this advertising ecosystem, is so great that it's very easy to trigger a panic. And Jonathan Mandel's speech helped trigger a panic. Where clients saying, oh, my God, we have to review our agencies, and agencies saying, oh, my God, we're not trusted. And then the ANA, which represents the clients, setting up an investigation with a security firm, and the agencies then say, oh, my God, they're hiring prosecutors to look at our behavior, increasing the level of mistrust. So it just created more turmoil in an industry already beset by a degree of turmoil.
Has the turmoil that began with that speech in 2015 resolved itself to some degree now?
No. I mean, I think there is a level of anxiety and mistrust that has had an impact. You've had a tremendous amount of the last, since that speech. And it wasn't the only cause of the turmoil, obviously. It was just one of several causes of the turmoil. But since that speech, there's been a tremendous amount of turnover. Of clients abandoning their traditional agencies and hiring new ones.
And this is where Michael Kassin comes in at MediaLink?
Yeah, MediaLink. I mean, generally at many of those reviews of what agency we should hire, Michael Kassin is sitting at the ear of the client, whispering in the client's ear and organizing the reviews and saying, all right, we'll have these three agencies come in. We'll tell the agencies what to present to the client. And then the client, with my help, will pick a new agency.
So, wow, just so many different directions to go looking at what's going on with advertising. Let me come back to the numbers, because Google, Facebook, et cetera, I mean, these are almost all ad-supported, as you point out, and making lots of ad money, aren't they?
Well, I mean, 97% of Facebook's revenues come from advertising. Almost 90% of Google's come from advertising. So they're advertising companies, but those ad dollars that they're getting, I mean, Facebook alone generates more advertising dollars than all the newspapers in America combined.
Well, I noticed, and you said too that the Newspapers Association of America doesn't release revenue figures anymore.
Well, they used to, because the numbers are so bad that they're embarrassed by them, so they don't share the numbers, but they just keep plummeting.
Wow.
Real problem.
It is. Ken Ouellette is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else, and we can certainly extend that to media and have, so lots of changes there. So we had all these media, like newspapers, like TV, that got most of their money from ads. I mean, so has the money essentially shifted wholesale from the old media to the more modern media?
Well, in some cases it has. I mean, for instance, the New York Times, which used to get 80% of its revenue from advertising, now gets about 46 or 47% of its revenue from advertising. The New Yorker, where I work, has gone from a majority of advertising dollars to a majority of subscription revenues. They could do that. The New Yorker could do it. The New York Times could do it. The Wall Street Journal could do it. The Economist magazine and the Financial Times could do it because they have an upscale audience. So they just raise the subscription price for their publications. But, you know, most newspapers in America can't afford to do that. So they're much more reliant on advertising. And that's a real problem, because those advertising dollars are shrinking.
Let's come back to some great history lessons you provide here. What was the first U.S. ad agency?
Oh, God, that was in the 19th century. It began. And slowly, and J. Walter Thompson was one of the most successful, which still exists. And basically, people realized that you needed a connection between the seller of a product and the potential buyer of that product, and you needed an ad to do it, and you needed agencies to do it. I mean, it used to be, if you go back and look in the newspapers prior to the Civil War, the whole front page was basically classified ads. But then at some point they said, no, we have to actually create, be a little more creative in the advertising to connect the buyer, the seller and the buyer. And then, of course, when you've got radio in at the turn of the century and then television in the, after the war, the ads became even more creative.
So before it was more or less a listing of things. The art really came into it with the creation of the agencies?
Well, the agencies and things like billboards. The automobile became, there were dozens of automobile manufacturers after the Model T, and they had to differentiate themselves. So you with billboards and then with radio and newspapers and magazines, and then eventually after the war with television, they began to differentiate themselves by creating ads that they hoped would sell the product.
One other little sidelight here in the historical sense, which is you bring up the fact that there was a nephew of Sigmund Freud involved in marketing. What was his job?
Edward Bernays was he wrote a book called Propaganda, but he didn't mean propaganda in the sense that we tend to think of propaganda today as manipulative or state-run. He saw it as just as a selling tool. A spin. This is the spin you have on a story idea. And he had a very successful ad agency, and he basically believed that, as Freud did, that you could mine the subconscious, and you could appeal to people by appealing to their subconscious. And he gave that advice to his clients, and he was very successful in the PR business of doing that. And obviously that has been extended into, it's been extended in the advertising world. Think about one of the most successful ads of all time, and one that ended the Mad Men series on television, was that Coca-Cola ad.
I'd like to teach
children
the world.
On it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Children on a Hillside. And every time I watch that ad, I get goosebumps, as many people do. But when you think about that ad, what does that ad tell you about Coca-Cola? Nothing. Nothing at all. It's totally emotional manipulation. And that is a very common thing. Look at the Budweiser ads in the Super Bowl. What does that tell you about Budweiser? Nothing. And usually nothing. And so that's the part where advertisers basically manipulate you with emotion, which is one of the reasons that people complain about advertising. On the other hand, there are brilliant advertising that does tell you something about a product. And increasingly what you see clients do, look at Colgate, for instance. Colgate does a 30-second Super Bowl ad, doesn't mention it's a toothpaste. What does it do? It tells you, don't shut off your water. Don't leave it running. You have to conserve water. So increasingly, products are trying to make the consumer feel good about them, that they perform some kind of a public service. They're not spoiling the environment, for instance. And increasingly, what clients are saying in advertising is that in order to differentiate the commodity product we have, how do you tell the difference between two toothpaste? They're commodity products. So one of the ways you distinguish them is to put a halo effect around yourself.
So if you're Colgate, you want to make sure that people have a good, warm, fuzzy feeling about you, and something that in some way you manage to imply that they're not going to feel about Aquafresh or something.
That's absolutely right.
Ken Ouellette is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, longtime New Yorker writer, author of many books. His latest is called Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business, and in parentheses, and everything else. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the approaches that companies take, and we were just talking toothpaste, so let's stick with a company that's been around for a long time, GE, because it's a great case study in the book. This is a very old company, and yet it did some things recently to appear cool and hip. What did GE do?
What GE did, they created characters, much like Apple created its character, the cool character, against the, against the Microsoft nerd in their ads of some years ago. They created the characters who basically seemed to be nerdy, but really were engineering driven. And part of GE's desire was to change their image from an old industrial company to kind of a dot-com company, a digital company, and they were trying to appeal to engineers, to hire engineers.
And all these companies are really competing for engineers, and it's a scarce market. There aren't that many engineers. So you're competing, if you're GE, you're competing against Google and Facebook and Amazon and all these companies that want to hire engineers, and ad agencies want to hire engineers to massage the data that they're collecting. And so what GE did was to do these tell these stories about this interesting character who was a very appealing character who was engineering driven. And in fact, GE's recruitment of engineers shot up because of it.
So
their stock price didn't, by the way.
That's exactly where it's going next. I checked GE stock price after reading this section of the book, and it's been on a steady downward trend for years now, hasn't it?
It's unbelievable, yes. I mean, even though they've had very creative advertising efforts, it has not at all affected their stock.
But you know, stock price is not the only indication of success. I mean, is GE still selling things? Are people still buying light bulbs? Well, actually, they're shedding their locomotive division, aren't they?
Yeah, well, they're actually, with the new, they ousted their longtime, Jeff Immelt, their longtime CEO, and promoted internally a candidate to be CEO, and he's announced that, he and the board have announced that they're going to shed some of the longtime GE divisions to try and, you know, jumpstart the company and its economic performance. But it has not been a great economic performer over the last decade or so.
So this would seem to point out a long-held truism of advertising, though, which is, you know, if the product's not great, or if the general feeling about the range of products you will have isn't great, advertising can't do anything for you.
Well, that's true. I mean, if the idea is that advertisers proclaim that advertising dollars spent should be seen as an investment, not as a cost. But if, in fact, your sales are not going up or your stock is declining, then you view it as a cost, not as an investment, because the investment's not working. And that's, you know, an ongoing problem. I mean, obviously, it's a reflection that GE has some problems. Maybe they're too big. Maybe they're in too many businesses. Maybe some of their businesses are old and they should, you know, be combined with some other company.
We are talking to Ken Auletta about advertising. His book is called Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. Here's a call from David in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Great topic. Thank you very much. I'm curious about the evolution of the tobacco industry in the advertising in light of what you just said about a product that has been proven to be detrimental to the public but still continues to be advertised. And if you could comment about the sophistication and evolution of the industry, I'd like that. And just a story. I have the original December issue of Life magazine, I think 1936. And the only two full-color ads in the magazine are for cigarettes, one for Camels. And on the rear cover, which I framed, is a full Norman Rockwell-esque picture of Santa Claus smoking a Lucky.
Wow.
With a handwritten Christmas card to you, wishing you the best of the holiday season from Lucky Strike.
Oh, wow. Thanks so much for sharing that. Appreciate that, David. Ken, your thoughts?
You know,
about
David, one of the things that the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, actually did intervene in terms of tobacco ads as well as ads for alcohol and banned them in certain places, and in order to, because they thought they were bad influence on kids or a bad influence on behavior of people. So those kind of ads you don't see anymore for say cigarettes, and you don't see it, certainly you don't see cigarette ads or alcohol ads on in many places, including television.
Right.
You see beer ads.
Right, beer ads, and in fact, some hard liquor ads, I notice, are getting back onto the airwaves. You know, you point out in the book, too, about how when the cigarette ads were supporting network news, network news didn't do a whole lot of stories about the testing on tobacco.
Absolutely right. And one of the issues that people make, Tim Wu wrote a book called The Attention Merchants last year, and in which he argued that, you know, we should replace, because advertisers have so much dominance, power, and because the people who take their ads often will not cover them, witness the example you just cited, we should replace it with subscription. And wouldn't we be better off as a society if that happened? And, you know, you can make the argument, of course we would be. And you would diminish the power of advertisers over, say, news. On the other hand, the question is, can the public afford subscriptions? One thing that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton agreed on in the 2016 presidential campaign is that the American working class and middle class, which is the bulk of the population of America, their income has been frozen for a decade. So the thought that they, who are currently paying roughly $260 a month for subscriptions, and they don't, and that does not include gas and electricity, that they could afford to substitute subscriptions for advertising, the math doesn't work. It won't happen.
No, it really didn't. Yeah, they think that that's a real can't afford kind of thing. The book is called Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. It's the work of Ken Auletta, a longtime writer of the Annals of Communication Profiles in The New Yorker and the author of 11 books. We'll come back and talk more with Ken and take some more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Advertising, the topic in this hour, and the wrenching changes in the advertising business, where we used to sit and watch TV commercials and maybe mute them, but we didn't have a choice because we couldn't stop or pause or fast forward. Well, those days are long gone, and the advertising business has had to keep up, and in large cases, it hasn't. So the result has been things like newspapers and TV stations losing large chunks of their revenue because they lost a lot of the ads. And look at Google and Facebook and the way they vacuum up dollars now. These and more are tracked in Ken Auletta's book, Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let us take a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Auletta.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Sure.
I don't know if this fits in, but you know, cigarette smoking, you're talking about cigarette ads. Well, cigarette smoking has plummeted over the decades. It's down to less than 20%. But when I talk to people, they don't believe me. They're sure it's gone up. And is there some connection to advertising? Or I found that, you know, some people are just kind of doom and gloom anyway. But people I'll talk to go, oh, no, it must be higher. But it's not. And if anybody questions that, any of our listeners, look it up.
Huh. Okay. Perceptions versus facts and advertising and how it intervenes in those, Ken.
Well, there's no question that decline of advertising of cigarettes has an impact on sales, but so does the message that is printed on every cigarette pack, which is that this could be dangerous to your health. You know, you have to factor that in as a consideration. And the growth of peer pressure in a society where people don't want to be in rooms with people smoking, and starting with Mayor Bloomberg in New York, but now it's spread everywhere, including London, where most places you can't light a cigarette up, and that's obviously has an impact on cigarette sales as well.
Well,
I mean, you feel like a fugitive if you smoke.
Right.
I don't, but I mean, I know people who do smoke, and they feel beleaguered by the pressure on them not to smoke.
Let's take another call, this one from Terry in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ken Auletta, the author of Frenemies.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is just concerns two quick items here, and it involves the compliance of the United States government. DTCPA, I'm sure that your author is direct to consumer product marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Advertising was enabled in the late 90s, to my understanding, due to lax regulations and whatever. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is watch TV today and see the psychologically designed huge letter advertisements every minute, you know. And the other thing, 10 years after that, was Citizens United versus the Trade Commission, you know, which basically made a corporation a person. Now, those two factors, I believe, are contributed greatly to the suffering we undergo daily with the onslaught, overload of quote-unquote advertising. That's it.
All right. Thanks for that. Appreciate it, Terry.
I mean, there's no question that Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, which basically allowed, which says that companies should be allowed to send messages and give as much as they can to political candidates, because otherwise you would violate their free speech. And that's what the caller meant by treating them as individuals and with their First Amendment rights. But that affects political advertising. It doesn't affect commercial advertising in terms of products, unless you consider candidates' products, which is probably a reasonable assumption. But so clearly, one of the things that television and publications like is election years, because they get all these advertising dollars coming in, and many of them come in from corporations that don't have the spending limits on them that individuals have, and that has an impact. But that doesn't, I think, spill over into ads for Procter & Gamble products. Now, the question of direct-to-consumer, one of the things that is happening, and I don't think this affects the point about ad glut, is that advertisers increasingly are saying, we want to have a direct relationship with our consumers. So Unilever, for instance, buys Dollar Shave Club for $1 billion. And one of the reasons they did that is to compete against Gillette, but basically because Dollar Shave Club had a website of all of their customers and with their email addresses. So they could, instead of spending money on ads on television, they could just instant message or email the members of the Dollar Shave Club and promote, you know, new products, new shaving products.
So in theory, advertising should be, and in a lot of cases certainly is, a bit more targeted than it used to be, because you can find, you know, people who like certain variations of your product certain ways, things like that, and target them through the likes of Facebook and all. So I guess these messages should certainly seem more personal than the broadcast ads we used to complain about, because there were 19 minutes an hour of them on broadcast TV. And in fact, I think they still are. But there still seems to be a lot of, like, even though it's like almost a personal invite, or has certainly gotten closer to that than it used to be, people still don't like having ads in front of them, do they?
No, but you see, you're getting to the future with the question you're asking, because if you press the advertisers and the clients, meaning the agencies and the clients, and the platforms, the publishing platforms, they will tell you that one of the keys to the future, one of the ways you get around the problem of interruptive ads that people hate, is you treat ads as a service. And therefore, the more we know about you and the data that companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon collect are so valuable, and agencies are trying to ape them in the data that they collect. So this is when people talk about big data, what they mean, that because we know so much about you, we can actually target messages to you that don't feel like ads. They feel like services. So therefore, Ken, you know, when you're walking by this clothing store, Brooks Brothers, let's say, and we know, Ken, that you bought a sport jacket 2 months ago at Brooks Brothers. And if you go into Brooks Brothers now, and this is on your cell phone, you have a GPS, they know where you are geographically, you are two blocks from another Brooks Brothers store. If you go in now, Ken, you can get 20% off on a new sport jacket. And will I see that as a service rather than an ad, an interruptive ad, you know, that I might like? On the other hand, will I see it as, how the hell do you know so much about me? Are you violating my privacy? And that's why this becomes a huge issue. As your ability to target people goes up, the privacy goes down. And as privacy protections go up, the ability to target people go down. It's a seesaw.
Right, and there's potentially a real creepy factor there. You know, if your phone pings and it's like, hey, Ken, you're right in our neighborhood. Do you want to get $20 off on that, or 20% off that suit? You know, and is the reaction different, too, because it is on a personal device as opposed to the TV across the room?
I think that's right. I mean, your cell phone is like your wallet or your purse. You don't lend it to someone. You don't hand it over to someone. It's a very personal device to you. And the thought that I'm going to wait 30 seconds for an ad that's going to consume my battery life, and that on my small screen it doesn't come in right, and basically it's interrupting what I'm doing, or I did a search for I wanted to read something and I have to watch your ad before I read something. I don't want that. And so the public increasingly is saying no, 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 no. So what advertisers are coming back and saying is, well, we have to figure out to do something different. And among the things they say to do different are targeted ads that really are personalized and give you something they think you actually want, as opposed to something that will feel like an interruption. By the way, the other thing that they do is they say, instead of the 30-second ad, what if we did six-second ads? Fox has been doing this, and some of the TV networks are doing six-second ads. But think about that. Think about how complicated that is. Let's say you have a two-minute block for ads.
Right.
And if you had six-second ads, you would have 20 ads in a two-minute block. Do you want to be the company with sandwiched between one of those, 19 of 20 six-second ads? I don't think so.
And will you pay more to be in position two instead of position eight?
Yeah, that's right.
So one of the other things, though, about, while we have this sophistication about how to assess what people's wants and needs are better than before, because we collect more information on them than before, it still seems like some lessons are getting learned very slowly. You can probably relate to the number of times you go to a web page and you're reading something that's important to you, and all of a sudden this ad pops up and shoves the page down out of your view. So you go down to look at the paragraph you're looking at, and then the ad disappears and it shoves the page back up again.
Or they tell you you can continue reading if you let us share your cookies, meaning your data.
Oh, right. Yeah.
In other words, we want access to your data. And if you say yes, we now have your cookie or access to your data. And some people willingly do that, and some people feel freaked out by it and don't.
We have an email here from Jan, no town given, says, back in the 50s, I read The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard. I never forgot the lessons learned about the ad business. This book led me to analyze everything I hear. That again from Jan. And so are we more savvy consumers of advertising, though? Not just in terms of I don't want that in front of me right now or on this device, but I mean, do we take advertising with more of a grain of salt? Does it have to be somewhat more sophisticated than Betty thinks you should buy this white bread?
I no question we do. Vance Packard's book came out in 1957, and it was a number one bestseller. It was wildly popular and had a big impact on the public. And his argument was that advertisers treat us like four-year-olds, and they emotionally manipulate us. I think the more ads you get over the years, the more people become more sophisticated about them, particularly as the devices on which you receive those ads, like cell phones, change. And so increasingly what you see advertisers doing is not just trying to target you with what they think of as useful information as opposed to an interruptive ad, but basically giving you, putting a halo effect, as I called it earlier, around their ads. So, one way we differentiate our commodity product, which is very hard to tell the difference between soaps or toothpaste, is we try and create a halo. We try and tell you the good things this company is doing for you. I mean, think about the Budweiser ads in the Super Bowl, which talk about immigration, and that's really an attempt to create a good feeling about Budweiser, just as Colgate's Conserve Water is meant to do the same for Colgate. And increasingly, clients are touting not their product, but their good intentions.
But that can backfire, too, can it? Because particularly now that people are aware of the term greenwashing, where it looks like this company is trying to be all nice and environmental. Meanwhile, they are filling landfills with all the plastic from their product, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a high wire act.
We have Jeff in Ashland emailed in, wants to know if you're familiar with the advertising expression herd 'em and heal 'em. Is that something you ran across, Ken?
No.
Huh.
What is it?
I think if I've heard the variation of this before, it's like you get people where they live, and it's like, oh, you're going to need this product, and then you kind of soothe things over later on after you know, you scare them first or something, and then make them feel whole. And maybe that's making them whole through their product.
One of the things, Jeffrey, that amuses me, when you watch these pharmaceutical ads, mm-hmm. particularly, let's say, on the evening news, which are aimed at their older audience, the first 15 minutes tell you how this product will heal you and the good things it will do. And the last 15 seconds of that ad, or even more in some cases, tell you this product may cause you death, this product may cause
right.
you... And it's quite unbelievable to listen to watch those ads, because they give equal time to the dangers of the pharmaceutical product as they do to the benefits.
So from the analysis you had to do for this book and all the research, I mean, do you get the sense that there's somebody who is as wise in the way advertising is conducted in the world today as a J. Walter Thompson was 100 years ago? I mean, is there anybody who's just that good at figuring out what people want and getting it to them and knowing all the pathways to reach them?
You know, I did about 450 interviews for this book, and any time I went into someone's office and they sat there smugly with absolute certainty and said, this is what the future is going to look like. This is how we're going to make money in our business. This is how ads are going to be shown. This is how the public will react to them. I wanted to put my pad down and escape because I said, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. He or she is just arrogant and full of himself and trying to spin me. And the truth is, no one really knows. I mean, people are guessing, and they have to guess. There's no way to know, you know, the outcome of how ads will work, what they'll work, whether the government will step in or not, whether ad agencies get too big and will decline, whether people will spend less money on ads, you know, whether privacy mm-hmm. will become the kind of issue in America that it is in Western Europe. These are unanswerable questions today.
All right, but you certainly take a stab at it. We have to go. The book is called Frenemies by Ken Auletta. Ken, thanks for joining us. This is the Jefferson Exchange. Have a great day.